Hi, I'm Taylor Smurl, and I'm an experienced bartender.
And I'm Tommy Smurl. I'm an experienced drinker.
He's my dad, and together this is...
Neat! A weekly booze cast.
With history lessons, trivia, and a twist.
So pull up a stool to the bar and join us for the lowdown on your highball.
Hello and welcome back to the show. Hey Dad, how you doing?
Hello Tater, doing good. How you doing?
I'm doing just fine.
That's good.
It's still sober January for you, so I was going to ask if you had anything good to drink this week. Yeah, any non-alcoholic beverages that you enjoyed?
Propels.
Okay.
Propels. I do have coffee in the morning before I go to work. I have been spicing some of them up with a cappuccino? No, is that right? What am I making?
Espresso,
yeah. I got confused.
Oh, okay, because I know you got that espresso machine for Christmas, so are you putting an espresso shot in your coffee?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, all right.
See, it works for on two levels. One, I like the extra flavor. The other is, though, Mom does not like strong coffee. Mom likes to be able to read the paper through the coffee, not that she would ever read a paper. You know, she's against that. She tells me that the news in the paper is not news, it's old. Because by the time you got it, it's from yesterday. She said, look at your phone.
Well, yeah.
But anyway, yeah. So she likes her coffee not too strong. So what I do is I make it so it's kind of about half of what I would normally want. But then I put a shot in there of espresso. And so then it makes it back to full speed.
Well, okay. 'Cause that is... What you're making is a red eye.
Oh, okay.
That's what that's called. A shot of regular coffee with a shot of espresso in it is in the coffee shop. We call that a red eye.
Well, I'd call it a white eye because it's trying to clear up my red eyes.
Well, it's like a red eye flight, I guess. Yeah. You stay up all night.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. Sometimes I put two shots in.
Well, I was going to say, if you put more than one shot in, usually we would call that a black eye.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of the way I like to do. That way, none of the coffee goes to waste. You know, well, Mom can drink it, I can drink it, and I just add a little bit of espresso to it.
That's good. Yeah, I ran out of coffee, and I tried to get through. I like tea. I drink tea, but I don't... Coffee I drink for function, tea I drink for flavor. And I tried to, like, just brew a pot of black tea this morning because I didn't want to spend any money. So, like, I've got tea in my house. I'll just drink tea. That's caffeine. It's not. I got up, I drank a whole pot of tea, and then I went back to bed.
Yeah, I don't know. Of course, caffeine doesn't really affect me. If I'm out somewhere, like at dinner or something like that, and they have a good dessert menu, I'll get a dessert with a cup of coffee with it and have it before I go home and go to bed, and it doesn't bother me.
Yeah. No, I'm in the same place. I have to have a significant amount of caffeine to function. That's the thing. It's not about being alert. It's that there's an amount I need to function. And if I don't reach that, then I'm just going to stay in shutdown mode all day.
Oh, yeah. I'll get a headache. If I don't drink any coffee, I'll have a headache within a couple hours of waking up.
Yeah. Well, it is a drug. It's an addictive substance.
Yeah, but I've cut way back, though. I used to, in my railroad days, I'd drink two pots of coffee a day.
Oh, yeah.
And now I just drink two cups. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, when I was running the coffee shop, I would if you want to properly like operate an espresso machine, you don't ever turn it off, but when you like warm it up the next day, you pull a bunch of shots to season or flavor the machine. Mm-hmm. You just want to make sure you've got, you know, all the chemicals out, all the water run through, everything's warm.
Right.
And so all of those seasoning shots, I would just pull into a cup. Which is drink the cup of all the bad shots that you pull to season the machine.
With all the chemicals and everything else.
I mean, hopefully you got most of the chemicals. But there's probably a little chemical residue in there. Yeah, just like four or five shots because we had a two-group head machine. So I'd pull three on each side and just drink them down.
Well, you get those cleaning chemicals in you. That'll take care of the COVID, according to Trump.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I'm such a healthy person. Anyway, all right. So this week, this sort of I've been thinking a lot about the concept of a modern classic. Since we talked about the Jasmine a few weeks ago, like that's kind of a unique, weird thing to happen because most of these drinks we talk about, we're talking about the people that made them. They've been dead for almost 100 years. You know, the stories around them are kind of lost to time. There's a lot of confusion. And then we have this new class of drinks that came about, like, starting in the 90s and up through the 2000s, where the people that made them are still, like, you know, you could call them up on the telephone. They're still out there.
Yeah, they're still out there. They're pretty young. Yeah, it's like we got the update on the one guy, and he's living in, what was it, Seattle or somewhere out that way, and had a wife and two kids or something like that, and ran a restaurant. Owned like, a restaurant. You
know, a lot of them, like, some of them are younger than you. Some of them are younger than me. Good for you.
Well, how cool would that be? How cool would that be to create a drink? I mean, even if it's a riff off of something else, that becomes a named drink in bars across the country, you know?
Yeah. Well, and there was sort of a hot moment for it. I think it's a lot harder now as cocktail menus have sort of become both ubiquitous and I think a lot more complex than they need to be. But that's a different episode. But there was definitely a time where the industry was ripe for new classics, especially in the early 2000s. And I don't think there's a bartender that sort of represents that moment better than Sam Ross.
Sam Ross.
Yeah.
I know I've never heard of him, or you may have mentioned him before, but I didn't know. It was just a name that flashed by and, you know.
Well, Sam Ross is, and I've never met the guy, but you know, he's always been a storied figure in the modern cocktail movement. He's just a year or two older than me. And painfully more accomplished. He was originally from Melbourne, Australia. He grew up working in cafes and bars as early as the age of 15. And he actually helped his family open a cocktail bar in Melbourne called Ginger's in 2001 before moving to New York City in 2004.
Hmm.
So same year I arrived.
Yeah.
He runs several successful bars and is acclaimed for his talents, and I don't know what I did. I do comics.
You do a successful podcast.
Anyway. Ross quickly fell in with some of the bartending big leagues of the time. You know, he worked for Sasha Petrosky. He worked for Audrey Saunders, who we talked about, who ran the Pegu Club, which was the drink that inspired the Jasmine, but then the cocktail bar. There was the old one. Then it went, it's all related. It all connects.
They're all somehow interrelated.
Yes. He all helped open Little Branch and Eastside Company. And probably most impactfully, he worked at Milk and Honey. Beloved, you know, much treasured cocktail bar led by Sasha Petrosky. So it was really just in the moment with the people that would define the cocktail resurgence in America. And in the spot when Milk and Honey unfortunately closed, he reopened in that same spot, Attaboy, which is a much beloved cocktail bar to this day.
Attaboy, that's what they told him when he opened it back up. Attaboy, we like this place.
Probably, yeah. And it's very different, but it's very intelligently... You know, when you look at Sam Ross's career and the way he makes drinks and everything he said about it, he seems to be somebody that just kind of is in tuned and gets it. Because Milk and Honey was very much that, you know, tiny vests and mustaches and a bit more of that, like, we want it to feel like a old-fashioned speakeasy. Whereas Attaboy is a little bit more casual. It's very modern. It's still just, I mean, it's solid cocktails all around. And he's spoken with a lot of love for the originators of the modern cocktail movement, that vest and silly mustache era, but that's the step forward. We've got to leave this was cool, we've got to leave this behind, we've got to bring it into the modern era. And he did that with his bar, and he also did that with his drinks. So the first of which I want to talk about, and you know, whether or not you've heard of Sam Ross, I bet you've heard of one of his most famous drinks, and that is the penicillin.
good for what ails you.
Well, yeah. Well, and it does. So the penicillin is, it's, you know, it's a riff off a whiskey sour, but I think it's more succinctly a riff off a Gold Rush, which I'll come back to. The penicillin is 2 ounces of blended scotch, 3/4 lemon, 3/4 honey ginger syrup. Sometimes you can sub that with just a honey syrup and muddled fresh ginger. And then after it's shaken out, you know, serve it with a float of a peaty single malt scotch on top, usually garnished with candied ginger. It's a delicious cocktail, and it was first served in 2005 at Milk and Honey.
And it was kind of spawned from a Gold Rush.
Yeah, well, that's kind of where it's when you start like learning all the little moments in cocktail history, things start to line up, because the Gold Rush, which was a product of like that was made about a decade before that, late 90s, I guess, at Milk and Honey. And that was from Sasha Petrosky was playing around with the honey syrup, which, of course, was something that, you know, was popular in like the Prohibition days. Honey masks a lot of harsh flavors better. So it makes sense that he was playing around with the honey syrup. And then that wound up going in the Gold Rush, which was basically a whiskey sour pared down to just be whiskey, lemon, and honey syrup. And that became a staple at Milk and Honey. That became a, you know, ubiquitous worldwide call drink. So when we look at what Sam Ross did, it's a lot of people will say, oh, the penicillin is a modified whiskey sour. It's like, well, no, the penicillin is a modified Gold Rush. But it builds on the fact that because the Gold Rush was so popular, honey syrup, by proxy, became a thing that most bars would have. So the ground has been laid for most bars to have honey syrup. Sam Ross presents the penicillin, which requires honey, and it makes it a lot more seamlessly incorporated into like cocktail history, because the Gold Rush laid the groundwork. I don't know. It's kind of cool. Like, why did most bars have honey syrup? Well, because of something that happened at that same bar a few years before that.
but that's intelligent, because you don't want to design a drink that has, you know, elements that you don't normally have at the bar. You have to go out of your way to get, because it's not going to catch on. It's not going to be popular, or it's not going to be available. So,
yeah.
So that's good that you build it in that manner and then say, now what can we do from there?
Well, it kind of walks a very thin line that, I don't know. It's at this period in time, you know, 2005, we're not in the days of like farmers market influenced seasonal menus of a ton of tinctures and infusions and foams and very finicky custom syrups and bars. This is still in the day where we're trying to re-educate people on just how to drink Manhattans and old fashions and, you know, like classics. Mm-hmm. So for him to do something that does have a little bit of chefiness to it, he was very ahead of that. That heralded a time to come where drinks became much more complicated and a lot more like you need 3 custom ingredients to make this. But the penicillin still manages to walk that line of like, yeah, you need honey syrup. Most bars have that. You do kind of need a ginger honey syrup, but you can just throw some fresh ginger in there and it works out. It's not too much of an ask to recreate in another bar. Mm-hmm. And I think that is, you know, any more specialized ingredients and no one would have caught on to this drink. And any less, and I don't think it would have been as unique as it was. So it just hit that sweet spot of, it's clearly a specialized recipe, but not so specialized you can't repeat it.
Yeah, ginger seems to be something that's readily available at most good cocktail bars.
I also love, like, the name penicillin, which, of course, offhand, like, you know, just credited to, like, oh, well, you honey and ginger are things you use when you're sick, right? But mm-hmm. that ginger element, I think it's cool because, you know, I mean, we talked about this on the first episode of the podcast. I don't think I've talked about it since, but like the word cocktail references ginger in a really gross way.
It's talking about horses.
Yeah, he would put a little nub of ginger up a horse's butt when they were on show for sale, you know, because it would make them alert. It would cock their tails. So that, and that also then plays into the early days of cocktails, which weren't for recreational use, but rather medicinal use. You would, you know, use an eye opener or a cocktail to get you up and going in the morning.
Yeah, whiskey sour is an eye-opener.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. That old-fashioned's were eye-opener. So I love the name because it's the medicinal reference ties it both back to the origin of cocktails, the medicinal use of cocktails. It's all there. Was he thinking of that? Who knows? He's a smart guy, but it fits either way.
Yeah, well, I tell you what, I've thought about that from time to time. And I thought, if I had to wake up in the morning and drink a whiskey sour, as much as I like them, I couldn't do it. It would make me sick. I can't drink when I wake up in the mornings.
Well, you know.
If I woke up at noon, maybe, but not when I wake up at 6 to go to work. I couldn't start drinking one then.
I mean, not if you're going to work to operate heavy machinery. I think there are some jobs like...
Well, is a car heavy machinery?
Well, yeah, actually, yeah, absolutely. So, no, yeah. Right. No,
yeah,
no,
I know. That.
No,
I mean.
I'm not going to judge anybody on how they self-medicate in this, you know, in capitalist hellscape. But also, no, don't drink before you drive a car.
When they prescribed it as an eye-opener, it had to be that you got to work on horse and buggy, and the horse did most of the driving. You know, you just kind of were along for the ride.
Well, we're long before the day of antidepressants, you know. It seemed like the, you know, pretty dark and industrialized days seemed pretty depressing. If you need a little whiskey to get going in the morning, whatever. Sure. Do your thing. Anyway.
Man.
So the penicillin. It works because of all of these really intricate moving parts. You know, the whiskey sour to the gold rush, the popularization of honey syrup, the sort of burgeoning chef bar cocktail thing that's going to come, but we're not quite there yet. It's a smart drink. It was a hit in New York first, but eventually it found its way around the globe. And now, you know, just as much as Sam Ross was sort of, he wasn't so much looking at the whiskey sour as he was looking at the gold rush. Now there are bartenders that aren't so much looking at the gold rush or the whiskey sour. They're looking at the penicillin when they're making their riffs, and they're just a million riffs on a penicillin out there that you'll encounter.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the growing organic creation process that is what bartending is, which is just really unique, I think. Sam Ross has a lot of hits. Like, this is, he's good at this. One of the other ones that I want to talk about, though, maybe because it's my personal favorite, is the paper plane. Have you ever heard of a paper plane, Dad?
I have never heard of a paper plane as far as a drink. Now, I've made plenty of paper planes before. Cooper just had me making them last weekend for some reason. I don't know.
Well, if Cooper had you making paper planes the cocktail, you know, I wouldn't be that surprised, actually, just with Cooper's vibe.
No, they were paper planes, the kind you fold and throw.
She's a cool baby. I don't know. hey, Pop, make me a paper plane. The paper plane came out a little after the penicillin, 2007, and it was developed specifically for a different bar. So Sam Ross and Sasha Petrosky, they were friends with another prominent bartender, Toby Maloney, who was opening a bar in Chicago called the Violet Hour. And he reached out to them basically to say, like, can you help develop a drink for my menu? Fun fact, I've worked with Toby Maloney.
You worked with Toby Maloney?
I've worked with Toby Maloney. I don't like to tell any experience I've had in the service industry that feels a little disparaging. I don't like to tell, but I've recounted this story in front of him and he laughs, so I don't think he minds.
Spill the tea.
It's not that hot. I will say first, I respect Toby. He was a very professional, like, good bartender to work with. I've worked with a lot of well-known people that were not so delightful. He was guest spotting at a place I worked at my first night barbacking there. So I had been doing daytime bartending shifts there, but I wanted to get night shifts, so that meant I had to barback first. So my first shift, I walk in and he's guest spotting. Big deal, Toby Maloney. You know, it's very slow, so I just walk up to him while we have a moment and hold out my hand, and I, you know, like, it's a pleasure to meet you, sir. Like, my name is Taylor. I'll be your barback tonight. And he just looks at my hand and says, "I've sent barbacks to the hospital before. Mind your space." And walks away.
Man, was that a threat?
I don't know. And I was terrified of him. And, you know, to be fair, like, there are a lot of bartenders that I worked with that I could name names, but I won't, that have no, like, elbowing, kicking, knocking a bar back into the wall. It's a common thing, and they don't give two shits about it. So that's, honestly, I think, a problem. I think part of your job as a bartender is to respect the job and the physical space of your bar back. It's not that hard to be have spatial awareness and, you know what's going on around you. I walked like I was a ghost when I was working behind him in the bar with him.
well, not only that, bar backs are human too. We just treat them with humanity.
Not old Toby Maloney. He honestly was not that. He had a very big part of that was he had a very big shake. Like he would do a pretty big dramatic jump on his shake, but like he would never do it when I was directly behind him with like two arms full of glassware. He was pretty aware of where I was, so I understood why he said that. But it all worked out fine. But there are other bartenders that whole baseline of respect you'd think it'd be there, but it wasn't. But that's
so Toby, his bark was worse than his bite.
Yeah. And I mean, I gave him a hard time about that comment much like years later. And, you know, he was always very kind. Like, nope, you were one of the best barbacks I ever worked with. And I never had a problem with you. And we're good. But old Toby Maloney, I did not know until researching this episode that he had a hand in the birth of the paper plane. So, you know, he'd ask them for this drink. Sam Ross did what Sam Ross does well. He, you know, took a classic cocktail structure and, you know, I don't want to say gave it a facelift, because he definitely created an entirely new drink that relies on completely different dynamics, but he did it while looking at the past, which I think is that's just correct. You have to learn how to walk before you can run. You have to learn the rules before you can break them. And the rules he chose to look at were those related to the last word.
So he gave him the recipe, but he gave it to him on a voicemail at about 3 o'clock in the morning that he sounded slightly buzzed on. And somehow Toby Maloney picked up that the name of it was the paper airplane instead of paper airplane. And paper. Instead of paper plane. Yeah. He put it down wrong on his menu. He put it down with this alternate name for it because he says, I swear that's what you told me.
Maybe that kind of works out because there are two alternatives on this. So the original recipe that Ross gave him was, you know, the last word classically is equal parts gin, lime, maraschino, and green chartreuse. They swapped this out for bourbon, lemon, Campari, and Amaro Nonino. That was the original recipe given. But after that, Sam Ross kind of went back to the, you know, drawing board and said, I don't know, I think this drink plays a little too bitter. I want to replace the Campari with Aperol, which is a little lighter, a little juicier, a little fruitier. And that's the version that then he like was like, no, actually do it this way. So now both, like, you know, apparently that original version with Campari that's a little bit more chaotic and a little bit more bitter, that still is something you can get served to you at the Violet Hour if you ask. I don't know if that's and then the more commonly understood recipe, though, if you get a paper plane at most bars, what you're gonna get is that Aperol Amaro Nonino bourbon and lemon version, which I prefer that one. We didn't mention that the name comes from the MIA song that was popular at the time. Just paper planes. There you go.
Right. Yeah.
So all sorts of confusion on that name. This song was paper planes. The cocktail was paper plane. Misconstrued as the airplane, but it all worked out. We got a delicious drink out.
There's drinking going on along with this information.
That's
an
important part of it.
and it also around that same time made the jump to Canada, to Toronto. It was a big one in the scene there, that it picked up in the bar scene and then spread to restaurants where restaurants were selling them.
Yeah, and there's a bar and a coffee shop named Paper Plane at this point that I know of. But it definitely, I mean, it was maybe even, and I think Sam Ross has said that himself, that he's obviously he's proud of all the cocktails he made, but he's maybe more proud of this than the penicillin, because it really is that one that, like, you don't need to turn on a burner to make this drink. You don't need to make any special ingredient. You just can have a well-stocked back bar. But of course, part of that well-stocked back bar that, you know, that this drink is credited for bringing to the front is that Amaro Nonino.
Mm-hmm.
This is delicious. It's a unique product. I won't go too into detail because, spoiler alert, we're going to talk all about Amaro Nonino next week. This is a little bit of a two-parter for you.
Yeah, I've never heard of that one either, so there's another one. The only thing I can say is I thought I was reading Nocino at first.
No.
It's Nonino, so I didn't know if it's... I didn't know Nonino. I didn't know if it's related to Nonino and Nocino or what.
If they somehow worked in a drink together, you could call it a no-no, and that'd be cute.
Yeah. We'll have to work on that. We'll riff something.
But the paper plane also, you know, this one really had the benefit of being both, it was on two prominent cocktail bars menus in two of the biggest cocktail cities at the time. So you had, you know, you had it on New York menus and on Chicago menus at the same time. And this really helped spread it as just this is a drink you should know how to make. Like, mm-hmm. It was not long. It was around this time that I was working in cocktail bars for the first time, and I heard about a paper plane. I never looked into the history. I just thought, oh, it must be like an old classic, like everything else. Like, nope, it just happened. the guy that made it is still working at the place he made it.
But it was responsible for making Nonino a regular thing in a bar, and the Elisabetta Nonino of Nonino fame thanked him for making their drink so prominent, as I guess it greatly increased their sales across the country.
Well, and I think that speaks to how much people enjoy this cocktail, but also it's so weird to me that, like, both the penicillin and the paper plane, if you try them and then you think about them in context of, like, more, like, pre-prohibition style drinks, like, more, like, medicinal, like, the style of drinks that a lot of these bars were working in, they really stand out as they're very big, they're very strong flavors. I mean, a paper plane to me is just so big and juicy and a little bit, like, absurd when you compare it to something. Like, the fact that it's based on a last word is kind of ridiculous because they are just night and day, but I think it's hard to have a style in any sort of artistic pursuit, and the fact that you can kind of get a sense of Sam Ross's style just from a handful of the drinks he's made, that they are very big, they have a lot of personality, and that also probably owes to why they make impacts.
Well, I think when it's a big swing too, when you make a jump from your base beer being gin to bourbon, I mean, you know, when you look at that being one of the things that they swapped out, that makes something entirely different tasting.
Well, and, you know, I can't know the thought process that he went through, but it is kind of fun to try to work through those thoughts. Like, if you started with that, like, well, let's make a bourbon last word. And then, you know, like, oh, well, lemon generally pairs more with bourbon than lime. So let's do the lemon. Mm-hmm. And then when you get to the modifiers, it's like, that's where stuff gets real weird. Like, you kind of ostensibly can say maraschino is a fruity liqueur, a fruity modifier, and green chartreuse is an herbal modifier. So we need a fruity modifier and an herbal modifier. But, like, you know, to bring in, like, orange and rhubarb, the kind of flavors that you get from what he ended up with, that ultimately those pair better with bourbon than things like, you know, like the more, like, medicinal herbaceousness of green chartreuse or the cherry of maraschino. So it all makes sense. But there's a lot of thought. You make one choice, and then that opens up five more choices you have to make, and then that choice opens up 10 more. And it's I don't know. I like that it's recent enough that you can kind of see what happened there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anyway, and goes to show, you know, and this is where we're at now, I think, with modern menus, is any menu I feel like you can look at and you can see the cocktail structure behind every house cocktail on the menu. Like, oh, that's a modified old fashioned. Oh, that's a modified martini. That's a modified Negroni. That's a modified sour. It's a modified Daisy. Like, that's fine. That's like the DNA of cocktails. But I think Sam Ross kind of picked that up and ran with it before anyone else was really doing that on such a visible platform.
Well, and then they had that one, the paper plane plus the last word kind of gave birth to a whole nother cocktail that I'd never heard of.
I think you're the Naked and Famous, right?
Right.
By Joaquin Simo. That is my favorite. I don't want to say I like it more than the paper plane. I think of them as two completely different cocktails. But the as far as mezcal cocktails goes, the Naked and Famous is probably my favorite. And that is, again, that equal parts build mezcal. But we got way back the chartreuse, but we got yellow chartreuse now. Aperol's still there, and now we're back to lime. So yeah, it is kind of a weird like volleying between.
Yeah. And I looked it up wrong. You gave me the name, and I looked it up wrong. Looked up Naked and Afraid, and that is not that is not the same thing as Naked and Famous. Although I wonder where that name came from. Naked and Famous.
I don't know. I love the name. I think Naked and Afraid is when you, I don't know, maybe you take the chartreuse out and you sub Malort in. I'm not sure.
Yeah, you're afraid to drink.
I don't know if that'll taste good, but it would work.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it's just cool. It's cool to just see that, like, and this is, I think, again, part of my thought process in this episode was that after talking last week about, you know, trademarking cocktails and, like, locking in recipes and locking in ingredients, that it kind of goes against what I think the heart of bartending, which is this, like... Mm-hmm. You always have to have respect for what came before you. And then you also have to have, like, knowledge and flexibility to change it and help it move forward into modern times. And that, and you know, you can't lock that in with trademarks and namesakes. I mean, Sam Ross is clearly accredited for both of these drinks. And the only things he's ever said is, like, I don't care if people riff on it, reimagine it, do it different ways. I don't like it when they, like, do it in a really shitty way. And I don't like it when companies try to put my name or the names of my cocktails on, like, a bottled cocktail. Like, I feel like it's overstepping to put, like, a bottled cocktail, a bottled penicillin or a bottled paper plane on the marketplace without Sam Ross getting a paycheck. I think is kind of messed up.
Well, yeah, I would think.
But
so.
But he hasn't tried to trademark any of this stuff, which I think is good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it, you know, it also, there's a difference between knowing how to make drinks. You can be a bartender that knows how to make drinks and being someone that understands how the flavors work together. And it's almost like being a chemist, that if you're going to put in this, you need this type of thing to balance it out. So
exactly.
You know, you have to know those things if you're going to start trying to put together some successful riffs or different drinks.
Yeah.
And that's real knowledge as opposed to just memorizing.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's like, I mean, in that way, it's, you know, again, it's math. It's math. It's, you've got a formula, you can plug in variables, but you ultimately have to solve for balance and to balance the equation. And that's something that, you know, I think that it took me a long time to understand how much of it is just that. How many classics go back to a basic understanding of structure and of balance and of formula. And then it's just, you know, then it's like, it feels like the keys to the kingdom, you know? It's like, oh, I know all the magician's secrets now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's what makes it interesting for me, too. I like seeing those kind of things. And, you know, it helps when you go to put something together. Or maybe you're out of something and you say, well, what can I use in exchange? Well, you don't just put anything in there. You got to find something that replaces the same profile as what you're missing.
Yeah. Well, and I think it makes it more approachable. And it's interesting because I also think, like, that change from milk and honey to attaboy, I think reflects an area where I think Sam is really smart in that, you know, it took me a long time to reconcile because my introduction to the bar, to cocktail bars, was very much to a lot of, like, I don't know how else to say it, other than very pretentious people who made me feel very stupid for not knowing things. And I didn't like that. That wasn't cool. I don't think it was particularly cool for customers, but it was at a weird place where, you know, these people trying to breathe life into a dead art form and force people to respect it. Mm-hmm. And that's a hard thing to do. And that kind of excuses a bit of that insistence of like, no, I need you to treat me with respect, and I'm going to be as like, you know, as aloof as possible, because you need to have reverence for this. Mm-hmm. And now we're past that. Like, we're kind of past that. We can relax now. We can have fun. Like, people respect cocktails. Everybody understands that there's a lot that goes into it. We can kind of pull back the curtain a little bit and say, yeah, but here's why it's cool and here's why it's fun. And also here's some weird shit that we can do with it. And I'm glad that we're in that phase. I hope we kind of push forward with that, you know?
Make it more casual and fun.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I like the little vest, but like unbutton a button or two on your little vest.
Yeah. Take off the dickie.
Sure, you know, loosen the bow tie. But again, I think that's something I don't like. Sam Ross is a 101 in understanding that, in understanding the ebb and flow of bar culture, I think.
All right.
And again, we'll come back next week and talk all about Nonino, the spirit that he helped put on the marketplace in America.
All right, that sounds good. Well, these are all things I've heard you refer to a penicillin, but other than that, all the rest of this was brand new information.
I did a frozen penicillin in our frozen drink machine one winter, because it was always hard to get those through the winter. So I was like, well, it's penicillin. It's a winter drink, but we'll make it cold. And I called it a penicillin, and I had like 3 bartender buddies send me pictures of other bars that had put in frozen penicillins on their menu called a penicillin. And I'm like, I'm not even mad. Like, it's right there.
Yeah, it's too easy.
Of course that's going to happen. But now after having read about him, I'm like, he's probably fine with that.
Yeah, he's cool with it.
Ha-ha.
Good old Sam.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us on this little journey, Dad.
Well, thank you for having me. I learned all kinds of crazy stuff.
Yeah. Thank you all for listening. If you want to find us on the socials, we are NeatBoozeCast on Instagram. We are NeatTheBoozeCast@gmail.com. If you want to email us, any questions, comments, what have you. And we have a Patreon. Check that out if you want to support us. That is the reason this podcast gets made. And if you want to talk about your, I don't know, whatever, your favorite Sam Ross cocktails, paper planes, penicillins, have you had them? Do you want to try them? Are you making them at home? You can do that.
At Neat the Boozecast group page on Facebook. You can penicillin us.
Go there, do that. All right. Well, thanks again. I've been Taylor Smurl.
I've been Tommy Smurl.
And this has been
I want to try one of those paper planes sometime. I've never even heard of that before. That sounds good. I can't believe I missed out on them at the beach. I don't know what was going on.
I know you would like to take a play back, but you would like to play some too. Yeah. As much as you love Elizabeth Sound.
I like the paper plane is kind of an orangish color.
It is.
And it just looked good when I saw the pictures of it. I thought, that looks like a drink I'd like to drink.
I mean, I feel like the first time I have one, I was like, this tastes like an adult Capri Sun. Like, I don't know. It's like just a big, juicy, fruity. I love it. Yeah, anyway.
There you go. Put them in bags and call them adult Capri Suns.
They're a great color for it.